Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and I've got some very interesting stories to share with you on today's podcast. It seems to me that I've inherited a dubious distinction, which is that I have become the tell-me-it-ain't-so doc. And what I mean by that is that as a result of my staunch and, I have to say so myself, pretty eloquent rebuttal of some of the stories that are in the media these days about harmful effects of supplements, that a lot of people are emailing me and posting on my Facebook page articles that they want me to rebut. So, for example, I talked about the carnitine study that purported to show that the supplement carnitine was bad for you and that meat, which is rich in carnitine, gives you a heart attack. But it turns out that actually most studies don't suggest that meat gives you cardiovascular disease. It's more about carbohydrates and sugar. And, oh, by the way, then they decided that it wasn't the carnitine. It was certain bacteria in your intestinal tract, and on it goes. And then there was the fish oil story, and we shot that one full of holes. And I felt like I was resting on my laurels until the other day when I seem to have gotten a spate of these requests from listeners and people who are my Facebook friends to basically tell them it ain't so. So one posting was from one of my Facebook friends about an article that purports to show that resveratrol impairs the benefits of exercise. And I think that this is along the lines of some studies, not too well done studies and studies that are easily refutable, which show that antioxidants might interfere with the benefits of exercise. So first of all, let me just tell you that I'm an inveterate exerciser. I still at the age of 60 compete and do races. Triathlons are my forte. And in fact, I won age group in my age category, which is 60 and older, in a triathlon last year. So, and I'm not saying that I'm some superb athlete, because when there's a lot of people competing in a triathlon at my age, there are actually plenty of 60-plus individuals who are faster and fitter. But I'm still in the game, and I take an enormous number of antioxidants. I take lots of vitamin C and mixed carotenoids and mixed tocopherol, vitamin E, rich in gamma tocopherol, and selenium and zinc. And I take all manner of natural antioxidants, including resveratrol. And so I guess one could argue, like, what a champion I would be if I simply didn't take any of these vitamins. These vitamins are holding me back. But they don't seem to be in this study of one, which I'm conducting on myself. So intuitively, I felt that there was something wrong with an article that suggests that resveratrol gets in the way of exercise performance. So I did my due diligence, and it wasn't too hard. I quickly came up with a bunch of articles that perfectly refute that absurd statement, and I'm going to share them with you. So here is one that supports the benefits of resveratrol for exercisers. It's entitled, and forgive me, it's not, these titles are not that scintillating. They're a little bit technical, but I'll share that with you. Suppression of the aging-associated decline in physical performance by a combination of resveratrol intake and habitual exercise in senescence-accelerated mice. I guess a senescence-accelerated mouse is a mouse that's genetically prone to aging. I mean, you can get all kinds of mice for experiments, and if you're impatient, you don't want to wait the 2 years before you have an old mouse. I guess you can order from a laboratory supply company mice that are likely to have premature aging. So what the study shows is, I mean, it starts out this way. They say, the decline in physical performance with increasing age is a crucial problem in our aging society. We examine the effects of resveratrol, a natural polyphenol present in grapes, in combination with habitual exercise on the aging-associated decline in physical performance in this particular breed of mice. And what they found was that the endurance capacity of mice undergoing an exercise regimen decreased over 12 weeks, right? They were 12 weeks older, so their endurance capacity decreased. 12 weeks is a long time in the life of a premature aging mouse. Whereas that of the mice fed resveratrol along with exercise remained significantly higher. Specifically, there was a significant increase in oxygen consumption and skeletal muscle levels of mitochondrial function-related enzymes. The mitochondria are the powerhouses of the cells, so that's good. These results suggest that the intake of resveratrol, together with habitual exercise, is beneficial for suppressing the aging-related decline in physical performance, and these effects are attributable, at least in part, to improved mitochondrial function in skeletal muscle. So, mice are not people, so you can't always extrapolate. But I am like an aging mouse in this experiment. I do a lot of exercise, and I take resveratrol on a daily basis. In fact, I take one capsule twice daily. And that's, my experiment. And the results of my experiment, I think, mirror the experiment with these mice. And there's some really cute pictures here of mice on a treadmill that look a little, they have like a little wizened, they have a little gray in their whiskers, but they're striding along very confidently and with a spring in their step on this little mouse treadmill. Very cute picture. And they did all kinds of measurements. They measured muscle force, and they measured oxygen consumption and carbon dioxide production and heat production and all kinds of metabolic factors. And they found that there were some distinct benefits to be had from the use of resveratrol. The resveratrol increased the isometric force production by skeletal muscles. The increased resveratrol in the diet enhanced cardiac muscle fatty acid oxidative capacity, which contributed to increased cardiac function in the rat. That's good because the heart is all muscle, and it helped the heart to pump. Results suggest resveratrol in the diets of... Now we're switching to rats. Okay, this is another experiment with resveratrol. Resveratrol, the diet of rats, increases the heart's ability to adapt to increased workloads that are induced by exercise. And the results also suggest that resveratrol supplementation during endurance training exercise alters cardiac energy metabolism and reduces cardiac inflammation. So now we're switching to rats. This is a second study. According to the results of this study, rats that consumed resveratrol as part of their daily diets during 12 weeks of endurance training. I thought those mice look a little big. As I flipped the page, that was actually a picture of a rat. Rats that consumed resveratrol as part of their daily diets during 12 weeks of endurance training were able to run longer and further than rats that underwent endurance training alone. So, what about humans? Would we see the same results? Or is this just a special occurrence for rodents? Well, they say recent studies have shown that resveratrol supplementation improved mitochondrial efficiency in overweight middle-aged men, which indicates the results we've seen here in rats may not be limited to that particular species. So, bottom line, they conclude that based on these results, resveratrol and exercise, specifically endurance training, act together to improve skeletal muscle oxidative capacity and metabolism, which overall aids in the significantly improved endurance capacity of the skeletal muscles. So, good news for consumers of resveratrol. And once again, I will verify that there's no need to be concerned about resveratrol consumption. If you're an exerciser, in fact, exercise is beneficial, and there should be no problem at all. Okay, So let's switch gears and talk now about another concern, you know, one of those tell me it ain't so posts. And the post, you know, I often talk about the downsides and dangers of statins. I'm not inalterably opposed to the use of statins. I think there's some people who probably really need them. And let's face it, the reality is that we're in a medical system where it's virtually malpractice not to put certain patients on statin drugs. If you've had a heart attack, most doctors insist that you be on a statin drug, at least for the foreseeable future, to reduce the risk of a subsequent heart attack. If you have very high risk after bypass surgery or after a stent, they'll make sure you're on a statin drug. So reality is that a lot of people, like it or not, they may need to be on statin drugs. But what about casual use of statin drugs for prevention? Well, often we're told statin drugs are beneficial, so why not take them? The side effects are minimal. They can reduce our risk of heart disease. And they always are looking for additional benefits of statins because that's what drug companies do. I mean, if it turns out that statin drugs could reduce the risk of cancer, they'd say, well, great, you know, we're kill two birds with one stone. We'll reduce the risk of heart disease. We'll reduce the risk of cancer. Recently, I shared with listeners an article that suggests that there may be an increased risk of breast cancer in women who take statin drugs. That's not entirely conclusive because some studies have not suggested there's an increased risk, but at the very least, claims for cancer protection are dubious. Now they've come up with an article that suggests that statin use may reduce Parkinson's risk. And that's a terrible condition. It affects, I think it affects a million or more Americans. So this is a big, numerically, a big disease. The article from Health Day News, millions of Americans take statins to lower their stroke and heart attack risks. But new research from Taiwan suggests the drugs may offer another health benefit, cutting the odds of developing Parkinson's disease. They found that patients taking certain statins like Zocor or Lipitor were about 58%. Wait a minute. Patients who discontinued taking fat-soluble statins were about 58% more likely to develop Parkinson's than those who kept taking the drugs. Okay, so the ones who discontinued taking the statins had a higher risk of. It's not quite like saying taking statin drugs prevents Parkinson's disease, but if you stop taking your statins, they say that you might have a higher risk of Parkinson's disease. So they admit that prior research examining the link between statin use and Parkinson's disease showed inconsistent results. So this is what I had to say, because I think this person was basically another one of those tell me it ain't so people, because they know that statins have their downsides, but they're thinking, well, more and more articles are suggesting that statins are beneficial. Maybe it's time for me to get on board because Parkinson's disease is a bad condition, and I certainly would like to prevent that. All right. I share with you now a posting from the Food and Drug Administration about how the Food and Drug Administration has recently changed safety information on statin drugs. Okay, there's a new black box warning on statin drugs that looks at the potential downsides. Now, this is not to say that people shouldn't take statin drugs, according to the FDA. They're very happy for people to take statin drugs, but they were forced to add some warnings. The warnings are about liver disease. Okay, well, we know about that. The FDA now says that you should have a liver function test soon after starting to take a statin or after switching to a new one. And that's something that I've known for a long time, is when I have patients on statin drugs, if we start them, which I rarely do, but if we start them, we pretty quickly do a repeat liver function test to make sure they're not in trouble, because fairly frequently liver problems arise. All right. Also blood sugar. In some clinical trials, participants who took a statin were more likely to develop higher blood sugar than those taking a placebo. The increases were 6 to 13%. So the concern is, could statins raise blood sugar? And there's now a warning about statins raising blood sugar. But here's my response to the Parkinson's brain protection theory about statin use. The FDA itself has a warning on the packaging material for each statin drug that memory loss is another possible side effect of statins. Reports in the FDA's adverse event reporting system include stories of mostly elderly men and women who experience memory loss or declines in thinking skills after taking a statin, which disappear when they stop the drug. So it's attributable to the statin, and this is a well-known phenomenon, is cases that even resemble Alzheimer's or dementia. And I've seen it in my practice, patients who experience depression, lethargy, confusion, memory loss, and they're so old and they have so little risk of cardiovascular disease that we say, you don't need to take your statin anymore. Let's give it a try. Get off your statin drug. And their memory and focus improves. So last time I checked, Parkinson's disease is a disease of the brain. I'm not a big fan of just dosing people with statin drugs if they have Parkinson's disease or if they're at risk for Parkinson's disease or on the mere supposition that they might be at risk for Parkinson's disease eventually, because the downsides for the brain outweigh the potential upside that this study shows. And, you know, once again, I got to say, here's a study and here's a headline, but these studies come and go, and sometimes they contradict each other. And so I'm not ready to hang my hat on the proposition that statins can reduce the risk of Parkinson's disease. All right, let's take a look now at nutrition in early life and its impact on the brain functioning of kids, even prenatal nutrition. Because when I was a kid, growing up in the 1950s, we didn't know much about nutrition. Now, no question, my parents were into healthy food, particularly because they were European, and they had a better sense of what fresh food was like from their European tradition. So I ate well. I'm not blaming my parents. But we didn't know much about essential fatty acids. And I was a very finicky kid. It's not my parents' fault. I hated fish. Didn't eat any fish. And I got to say, I was a challenging kid growing up. If I had grown up in today's environment, I might have been diagnosed as having attention deficit disorder. Sometimes that's the way it is with smart male kids in particular, girls too, but to a greater extent males. They're fidgety. They jump from one thing to another. They don't focus and concentrate. They act out. And I guess I was a handful. And that maybe, as I look back, that may be partially attributable to the fact that I got almost no omega-3 fatty acids. Fortunately, my mom ate fish, so I got some in utero, and that may have been my saving grace. But it wasn't until I was 13, 14, 15, or older that I began consuming more fish. I had an abhorrence for it. A lot of kids do. They just don't like, you know, fishy flavors, turn them off. We didn't know from supplementation in those days. Okay. Very interesting story in this week's Science Daily. Diets lacking omega-3s lead to anxiety, hyperactivity in teens. And they point to generational effects of omega-3 deficiencies. Here's the headline. Diets lacking omega-3 fatty acids found in foods like wild fish, some eggs, and grass-fed livestock. I didn't think we had that in the 50s and 60s, at least where I grew up in the city. I didn't grow up on a farm. Can have worsened effects over consecutive generations, especially affecting teens, according to University of Pittsburgh's study. Again, here they studied rodents, but what they found was that if you deprived an adult rat or mouse of omega-3 fatty acids, there were behavioral changes in the adult, but there were also behavioral changes in the offspring. A study shows that while the omega-3 deficiency influences the behavior of both adults and adolescents, the nature of this influence is different between the age groups. We observe changes in areas of the brain responsible for decision-making and habit formation. So this is something that can have an impact on the behavioral health of adolescents, not only because their diet is deficient, but because their parents' diet was deficient as well. And it's a particular concern because adolescence is a very vulnerable time for developing psychiatric disorders, including schizophrenia and addiction, according to the lead author of the paper, Dr. Beata Moghaddam. She's a professor of neuroscience at University of Pittsburgh. So the notion is that if you're contemplating motherhood, make sure that you get plenty of essential fatty acids, not from fish that are laden with mercury, but from fish oil capsules that are good quality and pure, or fish species that are not laden with mercury or PCBs. And the kids also can benefit from omega-3 supplementation. And there are various ways to get that into the kids. The product I like for kids is something called Core Omega. Core Omega is a product that kids can start taking at a very young age, you know, age, you know, two. It comes as a little, almost a little ketchup packets. And you tear open the packet and you squeeze out the emulsion that's in there. It's like kind of a gel. And the kids like the flavor because it's orange flavored or lemon flavored. And it's not fishy tasting. And that actually improves their brains and helps them to think and concentrate better. All right, so let's look at another effect of maternal nutrition. I hate it when I pass a fast food eatery, and although the problem is partially alleviated this week in New York because all the personnel in the fast food eateries, they went on strike. They want double their wages. They were getting something like $7.25 an hour. They want to make $15 an hour, a living wage. So they went on strike and they want the right to unionize. So there may actually be at least a temporary improvement in the situation because some of these fast food eateries were not online this week in New York. Probably, you know, it's not going to last for a long time. So the headline here: a maternal junk food diet alters development of the opioid pathway in the offspring. Now, what the heck is an opioid pathway? Well, opioid pathways have to do with feeling good, satisfied, relaxed, or alternatively high and intoxicated. Okay? Now, we have these opioid pathways in our brain for a reason, because we make our own opium-like chemicals. They're called endorphins, and that's the basis of a runner's high. It's also our way of responding properly to pain and stress. In response to pain and stress, we make more of our own endorphins. So it's a natural signaling pathway. Unfortunately, we figure out ways of taking a natural plant, the opium poppy, and chemically refining it into highly powerful heroin, or alternatively, we can do it with a coca plant. We can use cocaine, which works on a little different pathway, not precisely the opioid pathway. It works on a dopamine pathway. But what's also interesting is that the opioid pathway is also invoked when we eat foods that are high in fat and sugar. Wow. So a maternal diet that is high in junk food kind of changes the wiring in the brain of the baby and permanently alters the way that this system operates after birth. So without even the kid having his or her fast food meal or happy meal, as it's sometimes euphemistically referred to. By the way, that's psychologically very astute. Calling it a happy meal. Yeah, it plugs right in to that opium signaling pathway in your brain. So it is indeed a happy meal. Just like getting a needle stuck in your arm. And the implication is that mom's eating junk food. Well, number one, the junk food is bereft of omega-3 fatty acids. Even the fish dishes at those places, fried fish of inferior quality, doesn't yield much in the way of beneficial omega-3 fatty acids. So don't think you're getting your omega-3s that way. And then you eat a lot of sugary junk food that's flavor engineered to jazz your brain. Well, little baby inside mommy, developing brain, gets rewired around the taste sensations and the feel-good response that is evoked when these high-fat, high-sugar foods are consumed. And, oh boy, we're off to the races because we have raised an entire generation of kids whose brains may be wired permanently the wrong way, even before they take their first bite of junk food. That is super scary research. And it suggests that we're going to have to inform pregnant women about the enduring effect that their diet has on the development of their child's lifelong food preferences and the risk of negative metabolic outcomes like obesity, insulin resistance, diabetes, and ultimately heart disease. And oh, by the way, maybe, just maybe, a greater predisposition to other forms of addictive behavior, because you jazz the brain in one way, the brain looks for gratification in other ways, via drugs, via other addictive ways of getting high. Okay, I picked up this little item from a very nice website that I refer you to. It's Food Identity Theft, powered by Citizens for Health. And they've got very interesting articles on it. And this one is about a new natural sweetener called Truvia. And I think you probably have heard of Truvia. It's billed as nature's calorie-free sweetener. And it is actually an offshoot of stevia, the stevia phenomena. Now, many of you who are health food fanatics, you know about stevia. Stevia was something that was one of those best-kept secret things. It was a natural sweetener that you could find in health food stores. And what you had to do was add it to your foods to sweeten them. It wasn't perfect. It was a little bitter tasting, but at least it was a safe, natural, non-chemical sweetener that you could use in lieu of some of the horrible commercial sweeteners like NutraSweet. And we've had a lot of problems with those. It's not the time or place to go into all the potential downsides of NutraSweet. But suffice it to say that there are dangers and problems, and it's a highly chemicalized product, and it never should have been approved. And, oh, by the way, even though it's zero calorie, its main claim to fame is that it's a sugar substitute, so you don't gain weight. Well, studies show that if you consume a lot of NutraSweet, you either don't lose weight or you end up gaining more weight because you fool the body and you basically signal the brain that something sweet's coming down the pike, it doesn't deliver, and then your appetite for sweets is picked up, and you look for sweets and simple refined carbohydrates elsewhere. So in response to, you know, a lot of people are suspicious of NutraSweet, not the great unwashed multitude of Americans. They don't care. They're low information individuals, and they'll just consume whatever kind of chemicalized crap is present in diet sodas and diet foods even though it's highly chemicalized and dangerous. But there's a considerable proportion of Americans who are truly concerned about the chemicalized nature of food additives. And so stevia was truly an alternative for them. But there was a problem with stevia for many, many, many years. Is the soft drink industry and the candy industry blocked its adoption. Because I often wondered to myself, and I used to own a health food store, I said, why don't they have a whole slew of natural products that are sweetened with stevia? Why is it that if you want, say, something that's a little sweet, do you have to go out and buy some stevia, either in the granules or in a dropper, and add it to the product? Why do you have to go through those extra steps? Well, it turns out that there were some real obstacles to the approval of stevia. Why the FDA went to so much effort to block the use of stevia has never been made public. But some of the natural foods industry have alleged that the agency's actions were triggered, and I'm reading here from the Food Identity article, very nice article by Linda Bonvie that just got released this week. Why the FDA went to so much effort to block the use of stevia has never been made public, but some of the natural foods industry have alleged that the agency's actions were triggered by a, quote, trade complaint filed by the makers of NutraSweet, which is the original brand of aspartame, an artificial sweetener with a long record of health complaints. So they said, look, if there was a natural alternative to NutraSweet, that would kill our market. So they kind of slow-walked the approval of stevia. All right. In 2008, sweeteners containing stevia began hitting the supermarket shelves. Had the FDA changed its tune about allowing stevia to be advertised and sold as a sweetener? Well, this article continues, not exactly. In fact, the FDA doesn't even consider such products to be stevia at all, noting on its website that, quote, FDA has not objected to the use of these highly refined stevia preparations in food products since they're not stevia, but rather a highly purified product, which they prefer because a company called Cargill, a major, major food and chemical manufacturer, has now marketed Truvia, and I think it's fooling a lot of people into believing that it's just stevia. Let me tell you what Truvia really is. Truvia is merely 1% stevia, so they can make the claim that it's stevia-based because there's a little residual stevia in it. The rest is synthetic erythritol, which is derived from cornstarch in a patented process. So it's a highly industrialized process. It's patented. They own it. They can now make big profits. I think what the big obstacle to the adoption of stevia was, it was that how could they monetize it? How could they make a lot of money? Because a lot of small manufacturers, it was made, you know, in foreign countries from the stevia plant, and it was sort of like an herbal product. Not a lot of bucks there. But if you take a big chemical company like Cargill, and they've developed a patent for making erythritol, which is one of the constituents of stevia, but they purify it, made from cornstarch, which is plentiful. The Truvia box describes erythritol as a simple natural ingredient found in fruits like grapes and pears. Indeed it is, but amping it up to a high concentration and a large quantity, it's an untested proposition. The background on stevia was first discovered in Paraguay over a century ago, but the FDA blocked it. They launched an aggressive campaign to curtail its use in food and beverages that included all kinds of harassment, embargoes, searches, and seizures, calling it an unsafe food additive, although it had been widely used by the Japanese for decades without any complaints of adverse reactions. And It took DSHEA, which is the legislation that permits supplements to exist in the form that they're now available, to allow stevia to be legally imported, but only as a dietary supplement. So as a dietary supplement, they couldn't make any sweetness claims or they couldn't mix it into foods. But now Cargill has a lot more firepower than the country of Paraguay or the importers of this natural stevia, and they got it through. But something's happening here. Concerned citizens are suing Cargill. They filed a complaint this month in Hawaii federal court stating that the claim that Truvia is natural is a false claim. So this is like a class action suit. And I don't think they're trying to win a lot of money. They're just trying to prove the point. Truvia, made by Cargill is comprised of only a minute amount of the stevia-derived ingredient, the rest being synthetic erythritol that comes from cornstarch converted to glucose through the biochemical process of enzymatic hydrolysis, further fermented with yeast. That doesn't sound that appetizing. So it's not exactly what one would call, quote, nature's perfect sweetness, as advertised in the Truvia box, which describes the Truvia-making process as stevia leaves, quote, steeped in water that is similar to making tea. It is by no means such a gentle, natural process. It's a highly industrialized chemical process. So Cargill seems to be a little bit blindsided by this lawsuit. They actually have anticipated some pushback. One of the things that you do when you're trying to avoid bad publicity is you buy up a lot of websites and domain names. So they bought, you know, anticipating trouble. CargillTruviaNaturalLawsuit.com, CargillTruviaLawsuit.net, CargillTruviaClassAction.com. And I guess that was an effort to keep from spreading the word about this class action lawsuit, because the way that litigating law firms broadcast this is they set up websites, and then people can go to the websites and they can sign on to the lawsuit. So Cargill launched a preemptive strike earlier this year by themselves buying all these domain names to keep them out of circulation. So Cargill, for its part, says, quote, we're very excited about the future of Truvia. They estimate that the Truvia brand is predicted to be used in more than 1,300 foods and beverages this year, the most recent being something called Coca-Cola Life, which is a product that is being test marketed in Argentina. And so let's keep our eyes on this lawsuit, because I think it's an interesting lawsuit. Look, you want to call it Truvia. I mean, it's such a wholesome name. It's Truvia, like true stevia. But you got to provide people with a full disclosure of what the stuff is, because you can't take the positive aura of stevia and appropriate it for yourself and put a nice picture of a rainforest on the cover of your products to suggest that it's a natural herbal product. It's all a matter of image, because this is actually a synthetic product derived from cornstarch through a harsh chemical process that renders it into a synthetic sugar. That, by the way, is frankly very sweet and is almost low or no calories, no question that it delivers on the promise. It isn't what they claim it is. And now a lawsuit hopefully will shine the light of day on this situation. Find out about it at the website foodidentitytheft.com, powered by Citizens for Health. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks very much for joining us for this edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. And remember to check out drhoffman.com for a full roster of the products that we talk about, and also provide us with a little support and incentive to continue doing these podcasts by patronizing the Hoffman Center store at drhoffman.com. Our dispensary has a wide variety of natural products that are unique and fully curated by yours truly. Our prices are not to be beat, and if you find a price elsewhere on the internet that is better than the prices we have listed there, we will honor your price challenge and offer you the same product at the same price. Our prices are not to be beat, and we want to make sure that you get full access to the products that you need to maintain your health. Until the next time, thanks for joining us for the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.